Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'll be your host for the month of July. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meeting every Wednesday at noon Eastern on this virtual platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast every Friday on all podcast platforms, on aagrapevine.org, and on YouTube. This is an open meeting. Everyone is welcome. We are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. If you are new to AA and want to learn more about our program of recovery from alcoholism, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Contact with group members will help you find a sponsor and help you learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. This is the daily quote, which just popped up on my phone. Grapevine Daily Quote for July 15th, 2026. I don't believe I drank to get drunk, but always to seek in the next drink that peace for which a sick soul seems to thirst. And that is from a contributor in Los Angeles, California, and it was in the August 1965 issue of Grapevine. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a daily email at aagrapevine.org, or you will find it on the Grapevine app every morning. And we're going to try something new. So everyone say a little prayer. It works. Okay, so I'm going to play a story on the app for everybody. It's a quick story. And
AA in prison. The new me. After 20 years of AA in prison, he's not the same guy. With a sponsor's help and a good foundation, he's ready to get out and live.
I am now residing in a halfway house, my final step before freedom. I was in prison for 20 years. During my incarceration, I moved from a supermax to a max to a medium to a minimum institution. Now I'm here. I've done my time the same way I've stayed sober in prison, and that way is one day at a time. God willing, on June 20th, 2024, I will have 21 years sober. I owe it all to my higher power, AA, and my sponsor. God has kept me safe in a very dangerous place, and I'm so grateful for that. AA has kept me from drinking and has shown me how to be a better person. My sponsor took me through the steps, and he's given me valuable advice. He was just what I needed. I met him in county jail at the very start of my bid. He has visited me in every prison I've been held in. He's my counselor, and I consider him family. Here's what I needed from him. He puts up with none of my manipulation or excuses. He calls me out when I'm heading in the wrong direction. I hope everyone can find a sponsor as good as mine. I'm so thankful for him. Prison can be a depressing place, and to not drink, you must really work your program. And I did. I needed to get involved with positive activities. Find people in here who don't drink or use and spend time with my higher power every day. This was not always easy. There are a lot of temptations in here for people. Sadly, prison isn't everyone's rock bottom. My life was always centered on drinking and using other substances, but not anymore. I know as I prepare to head out into the world again, things won't be easy. Over the past 20 years, I've taken dozens of educational programs. I've sponsored a few people, helped start an AA group in here, made amends to everyone, and cleaned up my side of the street. I have put in the work to build a strong foundation for when I get out. But most importantly, I've stayed sober. I can never forget the horrible crime I committed. But I do know that today I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. Today I help others. I no longer hurt them. Today I give. I don't take. I no longer want to hurt myself. Today I can be trusted. And most of all, today I love myself. Like most alcoholics, I had very low self-esteem. I didn't like myself at all. But thanks to my higher power, I now love who and what I am. It took time for me to forgive myself. It has been a long process. I put in a lot of work and I live by the motto, no change means no change, period. I had to change everything. With the help of God, I've created a whole new me, and I'm not done yet. I will never be perfect, but I'm sure better today than I was 20 years ago. In 2 years, I'm scheduled to be released back into society. I'm making plans to attend AA on a regular basis so I can keep my sobriety and focus. I can't put anything before that, not anything. I don't miss the old person I once was. The new me is much better. John S., Newark, New Jersey.
Thank you, John. Okay, and now we're reading from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is from the famous acceptance reading from page 417, but I always start at the bottom of 416. At last, acceptance proved to be the key to my drinking problem. After I had been around AA for 7 months, tapering off alcohol and pills, not finding the program working very well, I was finally able to say, "Okay, God, it is true that I, of all people, strange as it may seem, and even though I didn't give my permission, really, really am an alcoholic of sorts. And it's all right with me. Now, what am I going to do about it?" When I stopped living in the problem and began living in the answer, the problem went away. From that moment on, I have not had a single compulsion to drink. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." He forgot to mention that I was the chief critic. I was always able to see the flaw in every person, every situation, and I was always glad to point it out, because I knew you wanted perfection, just as I did. AA and acceptance have taught me that there is a bit of good in the worst of us, and a bit of bad in the best of us, that we are all children of God, and we each have the right to be here. When I complain about me or about you, I am complaining about God's handiwork, and I am saying that I know better than God. Okay, this will be a two-speaker meeting. There will be no sharing by attendees, so please sit back, relax, and listen. We often hear it is best to try to identify with the speakers rather than compare your story with theirs. Okay, our first speaker I got to know very, very well over the past couple of years. Kimberly and I worked together, and she's been a real asset for the Grapevine in so many ways, and I'm eager to hear her story. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Thank you, Chris. Hi, everybody. My name is Kimberly. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for asking me to speak. And thanks for having this meeting. I was listening to the podcast in my car this weekend, and I heard your story about how you fell asleep on the beach with the boombox and you had burns. And I said, oh my gosh, I fell asleep on the beach too because of drinking. And like, I don't have freckles. These are not freckles. These are sunspots from when I fell asleep on the beach because I was passed out. So I definitely, I identified with your story when you mentioned that. Some backgrounds on me. I am a child of an alcoholic. I'm an adopted child. My biological family has active alcoholism in it. And the reason that I was adopted was because my mother could not get sober, nor could my father. And I was in foster care from the age of 6 months old with my biological sister to right before I was six, so about 5 and a half years. Monica was 2 years older than me, and we were both very low birth babies, low birth weight babies. Monica was about 4 pounds something ounces, and I was also about 4 pounds. And it was because my mother was active during her pregnancy. So that paints the picture of where I think I got my alcoholism from. I had the isms right from like a little child. I remember I always craved sweets as a child, and I would go into like the pudding packs because I was a hyperactive child, and I'd go into the pudding packs and I'd like eat the dry pudding because I just wanted sugar. And then I would also and then I'd hide them like the open box. And this like and then I'd go into one time I went into the refrigerator and like there was baking chocolate and I was like, oh yeah, chocolate. And I bit into it and it was like, ugh, there's no sugar in it. And my dad found it. Like he found, like he go like and he looked and he like did this forensic like tooth and out. Like he put it up and I had to bite down and he was like, all right, bite down. And he's like, yep, it's a match. And I'm like, nope, it wasn't me. So you know, right from a child, I can go back and I think, wow, I had the isms, like the behaviors. And I, you know, I was adopted into a wonderful, you know, family. I had, you know, both myself and my biological sister were adopted together. I remember I have this picture of when we, like literally I was picked out of a binder. Like my mom was looking through a binder and she looked at my picture and she looked at my sister Monica, and Monica had the same birthday as my uncle. I looked like my Aunt Fran. I had a papa's birthday. So they were all little things that, you know, felt right for my mother. And hindsight looking back, I know my higher power was involved in my life many times. And that is definitely one of them. So I like to say I was like a cute little puppy picked out, you know. And they had another adopted child and then two of their own. So big, you know, five girls, my father, my mom, dogs, you know, my dad. I went to private school. Like it was a good life. And you know, 18, 19, I did what an 18, 19 year old, you know, did. And you know, I went to college to be a pilot. I partied, but I'm not a pilot. Just for the record, I then stopped going to taking I stopped taking flight lessons. I moved into Manhattan to be a bartender. I bartended on the Upper West Side by the Beacon, by the theater, the Beacon Theater there in the 77s, and just off to the races. The progression of the disease, like it talks about in the big book. In my mid-20s, I found out I was pregnant and I had a child of my own. And I said, you know what? I'm never going to be like my mother. And I quit drinking. I'm going to have a healthy pregnancy. I moved back home. And what did I do? The progression of the disease. I'm just going to backpedal for a minute because One thing that I feel helped me in my recovery was looking at when I was in foster care. You know, that photo of me and Monica together picked out of a binder. I think I was 5 and a half, 6, and I was with my foster mother, and she's crying on the steps, and all like I'm watching mine and Monica's stuff in plastic bags leave the house, being put into a trunk of a car, and I'm like, what's going on? And she says, you're going to now live with that family. And at that age, I didn't understand. Like, all of a sudden, I've got another parent, like new parents. So by like 6 years old, I've already had 3 mothers and 3 fathers, and who knows how many siblings and pets. So it was very confusing as a child. And I bring that up because that has something to do with further down in my journey. How did I get to AA? Well, I moved back home with my 6-month-old daughter. Her father was not a very good father, and I didn't want to repeat history. And in a way, I did, because I still had, like, I was drinking and a bigger bottle, a box. And then I'm hiding the box in the closet, like I did with the Jell-O pudding packs. And it just continuously, just, you know, hiding. And it was because I got caught drinking out of a bottle in my bedroom. I had a family member walk in on me on my bedroom, and I'm like in the middle of a swig. So I said what I thought they might want to hear. I'll go and to AA meetings. Where I heard that, I don't know. And that was in 2006. My daughter was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years old. And I was the epitome of what not to do in the program. I treated AA like a buffet, like a little of this, a little of that. I don't want any of that. You can keep that side. Uh-uh. And I was not sober. I was not honest. I found a partner. I think he had 3 months sober, 3 months sober at the time. I don't even know if I had a day. And, you know, everything was great. 2 years later, we're engaged. Life is wonderful. I think I also might have celebrated a couple of fake anniversaries that I was never sober for. And I was also the person that had like the bottle underneath the front seat of the car. I'm an unconvicted felon. I was not safe with my child. And then he texted me that he wanted the ring back. And I was like, man, you texted me that the engagement is over? And I gave the ring back, and I laugh at it now. But man, off to the races. Great excuse to just, you know. And that those years, it worse, worse, worse. It was like a trap door. It just kept the bottoms just worse, worse, worse. So I came in because I got caught drinking, but now I've got legals. Now I can't live with my daughter. Now my parents have temporary custody. And now I start the rotation of the in and out of rehabs, in and institutions. Just like the story, I was in and out of halfway houses, sober houses, therapeutic communities. It got to the point where I think one time my sister called the cops on me. And I don't know, I was so inebriated. I just walked out of my parents' house with my daughter. Said, I'm going to the city. And I walked through the back of a pizzeria like I own the place. And I called my cab, and I see cop cars come up. Later on in sobriety, my daughter told me that I went right up to the cops and said, are you looking for me? I didn't remember it that way. I remembered it that I was trying to escape and they found me. And I remembered that my aunt showed up and grabbed my daughter. And then I tried to escape the hospital that I was escorted to. And I got out. Like it was like a Mission Impossible theme song in my head. And I'm just like, and I got out and I'm almost at like off the hospital grounds. And they have, you know, it was a, they have their police. And the police officer asks me, "Are you Kimberly?" I had, you know what? I could have been anybody. I could have said no. And I said yes. And that led to court and judges and repeat visits to court. And that couldn't even keep me sober. Like here I was, and this substance had power over me. I had this beautiful little girl, and I said I wasn't going to be my mother, my biological mother. Later on, my in sobriety, I found out that, well, the judge didn't like me, and he didn't like me because I came up with stupid things. Like I he got a report that I was drinking, and he said, "What happened?" And I said, "I went to." And I had pina colada cheesecake, I don't know. And he had, it was, he was done with me. So he told my parents to adopt my daughter. And my parents refused. They said, "No, we have hope. We have hope that she'll get it." I now, my last time in front of the judge, it was like December 2012. And he said, "Kim, the only reason I am not putting you in jail is because it's the holidays and I don't want to ruin your daughter's holiday." By then I was scared. I was scared of jail. Put myself back into another rehab. And while I'm in this rehab, my counselor brings me into the office and says, "Your sister's in the hospital." Now, this is the sister that was by my side, my adopted sister. She was, I mentioned that she suffered the physical ailments of my maternal mother's choices, fetal alcohol syndrome, autistic. She was deaf. And her organs were, they were not strong enough. So the judge let me out of rehab to say goodbye to her. And the judge let me out of rehab to go to the wake. And the judge let me out of rehab to go to the funeral. Now, when I first came into AA, this was 2012. When I first came into AA in 2006, I always had that reservation that if my sister passed away, I was going to drink. And it talks about in our literature that we can't, like, we're to have none. And I truly believe it was my higher power that carried me through that. And it was in that hospital room that I had my surrender moment where I said, "Wow, I just stayed sober." And after that, I said, "Well, if my sister can fight, she was lived 10 years past her life expectancy. She could fight all her life with her handicaps. Why was I letting this bottle, this fluid, why was I letting it take over my life? Like, why wasn't I doing like there's an easier, softer way?" So when I got out of that rehab, that's when I said, "That's it. I'm done. Time for me to grow up." And I went to my last sober house and I found somebody that I didn't think she'd have anything in common with me. Like she could have been like my great aunt. And I did the work. I did the work as outlined in our literature. It was the first time in all of that time floundering and being a wallflower, that I actually did the work. And not only for me to trust someone to do that work with, because remember, I had three moms and three dads before the age of six. I didn't trust anybody. The fact that I trusted somebody to do that work, to tell my darkest, deepest secrets, was a miracle. And yet another moment that of hope that I could give to somebody else, because I didn't trust anybody. From there, things, I slowly started to, you know, get things back fairly quickly, just like it talks about in the promises, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And I, I was able to move back home. You know, I graduated from court. I no longer had, child protective services. And what do I do then? I continue to do this program. And I have my home group. I, you know, go to my meetings. And up until then, I wasn't able to have healthy relationships. And slowly but surely, because of practicing this program in all my affairs, I was able to make friendship with women. I was able to be a family member. And I remember at my 5 year, that was when my father told me that, you know, they wanted to adopt my child. And at my 5 year, my father gave me a heart that said hope with my birthstone in it. He said, this is what we had for Kimberly in her journey. In that time, now I have my daughter and she's turning into a teenager. And she has her emotional scars and she's a teenager. And now I have a sober support network of women to support me in helping her to grow up. She's now, since she's 22 years old, she lives in California. She went cross country right after she graduated high school, and she's on her own journey. It's like she's living the LA life. And I went to see her last year and I saw myself in her, like mirror. And I just know that she has her process and her journey. A lot of life has happened in these last 14 and a half years. I would say that right now I'm at that emotional sobriety piece, that where I must, for me, make sure that I pause every day and have, you know, that constant contact with my higher power. You know, I call on God because that's what I'm used to. And sometimes, you know, he's just sitting in the car with me and I can talk to him. It's important that I do this every day thoroughly to the best of my ability. I practice it far from perfect. I've made mistakes, but at the same time, I've also been able to be a member of my family, suit up, show up. We just had a loss this weekend. And I tried to be the positive touch to it. I was at a beginner's meeting on Monday and a woman shared that, like, I'm here because I think I need to be here. One of the things that I love to do in service is to connect with women, show them the tools we have. I showed her the Grapevine app, podcast, the magazines. That's what I like to do today to keep me aligned. So thank you for letting me speak. And now you've heard my story, Chris.
Thanks so much, Kimberly. Beautiful. Wow. Very admirable. My poor mother, when I was born, I was 9 pounds. So rather large. But I also could identify, I know you've been through a loss in your family recently, and I just, I haven't had that happen in a while for me, and I'm glad, grateful. But when it did, when I was sober, I remember showing up for my family, especially around my brother's death. The fact that I was there for my parents as a sober person was something I'll always be grateful for, and I think they were grateful for as well. Okay, some announcements. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group should be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix, and you can find it on AA.org. Grapevine does not accept direct contributions, but of course we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store on your phone. You can also purchase Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By doing so, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and your local office. You can also visit Grapevine online store at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message Project allows you to help us help others by providing magazine subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our other weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour, which is available for free on all podcast platforms and on aagrapevine.org. And please check out Our Primary Purpose, the official podcast of the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tune in to hear how AA's message continues to reach those who need it most. For all podcasts, be sure to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform so you can catch all the episodes. And please follow Grapevine on Instagram and YouTube as well. Okay, the next speaker is Rich. Rich and I have been friends for about 20 years. We met working on a project together, a couple of projects together. And I'll let him tell you about that if he wishes. And Rich, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rich, and I am most certainly an alcoholic. Right off the top, Chris, thank you very much for inviting me and giving the opportunity to share. Unless there is no way to avoid it, I learned early on to say yes every time asked, and I have never been disappointed as a result. Which is a perfect segue into thanking you, Kimberly, for your share and your unflinching honesty. A very interesting visual note. People out in audio land won't be able to see this, but with your background, blanking out your environment, some of the white AA Grapevine background was coming in on the V cut of your shirt and turning into an actual heart. And then I was pinging to that. I'm a visual artist, and seeing that shape show up again and again. And then at the end of your share, you were given a heart pendant. I was like, wow, how perfectly, delicately coincidental is that? Which, and it's going to sound like I scripted this. Swear to God, I didn't even write down topics. That is another segue into the greatest lesson, probably the greatest lesson in terms of its impact on me that I learned in AA was my very first willing, consciously chosen to go to AA meeting of my life in July 2006. Another coincidence. At that very first meeting, it's a big book meeting in the basement of a church, and a great local group that still exists, still goes every Sunday evening. Someone said, "Identify, don't compare," at the end of her share. And I have said this over and over again. I've said it so often that it sounds almost rote to my own ears, but I swear to you, anyone listening, the greatest lesson you can learn is to identify, not compare with anyone else's story, because Kimberly and I have some overlapping experience, but we don't have the same experience. I'm half adopted because my mother gave birth to me when she was very young, was married to an active alcoholic. My mother had active alcoholism on both sides of her family tree. So I was, also the biological byproduct and predisposition towards alcoholism. My mother married someone who ended up adopting me. So I share that strange displacement of adoption and awareness of a parent who isn't biologically mine, but still treated me as best he could as his own son. Not surprising coincidence, the longer I'm around, the more I hear and the more reading I do on the subject. Though he was not an alcohol abuser, my father's addictions carried themselves out in cigarettes and food. He came from a horrible alcoholic environment. These things might seem like coincidence, but, you do find that we vibrate on a frequency and we do find each other. It seems that a lot of the pathology, a lot of the behavior, a lot of the experience that we have ends up very parallel. And when my head was full of alcohol and anger and resentment, God, the resentment, the entitlement that comes with all the isms that I had from a very early age, I was not in a position to see how those overlaps were part of a physical, spiritual, and mental disease. Now with, just recently cresting the 20-year milestone, I see that with a clarity that I could not have had. I mean, I was a functioning person, as Chris said. We worked on a lot of projects prior to me coming into AA on my own. We first met in 2002, working on these projects. One of the projects we worked on did involve AA's outreach to prisons. So today's reading, being from AA in prison, was another just, how many coincidences can, you know, overlap and have a domino effect like this? I don't know, but all that aside, just to share my experience, I was born, you know, I'm wearing a 1969 t-shirt again, coincidentally, because somehow, you know, this is all anniversaries. I was born at the tail end of the 60s. As I said, my mom got married right out of high school, had me when she was 19. Had to divorce my biological father, married the man who I understood as my father when I was a year and a half old, and he adopted me when I was two and a half years old after the birth of my sister. Biologically, she's my half-sister, but she's my sister, who also, by the way, is on her second run through of you know, pretty long-term sobriety. She put a long time together and then thought she had graduated, and now she's been back for a few years. I was born and raised in the lower middle class suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. So anybody who knows anything about Cleveland, the caricature is not inaccurate. It is a hardworking, hard-drinking, particularly in the middle and lower middle-class areas, very, very hard-scrabble environment. Both my parents actually worked like animals. Despite all their difficulties, the one thing that they instilled in me was the value of hard work. That ties in much later to some of my addictive pathology. That's work that I've had to do in that regard much later in life. But alcohol was around not just because of biological and adoptive family. You know, when I was 5 years old, my dad's father was always drinking, just sat there quietly, but just, I mean, he had to have a constant point to BAC. I mean, from, you know, from morning till night. And he would have a little bit of beer left over, and oh, wasn't it cute to let, you know, little Richie go and have a sip of, you know, the last of the beer in the can. And my friends, again, my environment, we all understood drinking to be an escape from what seemed to be, you know, difficult circumstances. It really weren't. You know, sure, there were tough guys and, you know, there were tough areas, but it really was the, I mean, it was the 70s and 80s. It was the, you know, the fallout from the Vietnam era and the disillusionment with the post-war promise, it seems. And both biologically and environmentally, because both my parents worked, they got divorced when I was 10 years old. Then they got back together, even though they didn't get remarried. They stayed together while being divorced, and then we moved to California for a time, and then we came back, and then they split up, and then my dad was away for a bunch of years. Then he moved back to Ohio, and then they got back together, still not married, and then on and on and on with the chaos. And because my mom was a single mother for much of the time that my sister and I were growing up, I understood instability. I understood you know, what it was like to be in an empty home and somewhat raising ourselves, my sister and me. As mischievous by nature, you know, very hyperactive, it's what they called it when I was a kid. And I would drink with friends starting at about age 12, a couple, three times a year. And then in high school, we did the high school thing. You know, you would drink on weekends with your friends and act the fool. What I didn't understand at the time and can see now with hindsight is that I was acting the fool in a much bigger way than my peers. I was the one that the parents made an example of. I was the one the teachers made an example of. I was the one who drove my dad's car in high school into a spruce tree right down the street from my grandfather's place because I got horribly lit up at one of these stupid high school parties and decided to drive my dad's car home with a 0.22 BAC at age 17. So, you know, being 17, the juvenile court had jurisdiction over what to do with my tickets, you know, obvious DWI, so obvious that when the police came and got me out of the car and told me that I was under arrest in the back of the police car, I said, "What's the charge?" The nerve, the chutzpah of this 17-year-old jerk to say, "What's the charge?" as he smells like, you know, an absolute open bar. Juvenile court highly recommended that I attend a few AA meetings while they decided what to do with my license. And at age 17, I went into the basement of a rec room with grown adults like us telling their stories. And it scared the living daylights out of me. It scared me very, very, very badly because these were, again, the people in their 30s and their 40s, having lived the experience that we've lived, telling stories about the things that we've done as grownups to a 17-year-old. And I didn't have that scared straight experience of like, wow, I've got to straighten up. I've had the experience of, I'm not anything like these people. I got to get out of here. So I did get out of there. And part of my court-mandated experience was to go to a two-week alcohol rehab and awareness program with other kids who had had alcohol problems. And I enjoyed my experience there, but was very scared by AA. And when I told the court-appointed person that, you know, AA meeting scared me very badly, but I got a lot out of this counseling. He said, "Well, that's all well and good, but your license is suspended until you turn 18 and you're back in the adult." And that just seemed to be, you know, again, with the lack of clarity of youth and, you know, active isms, it's like, well, you know, I go and do the right thing and I do what you tell me to do. And, you know, I still get penalized like this, you know, the heck with this, this is garbage. So, you know, I continued to think I was just a problem drinker. My first weekend in college, I had another encounter with law enforcement while still thinking that I was just a problem drinker. Had some consequences that almost involved me getting kicked out of school. But again, I went to a party college. I was not the only college-aged kid in the drunk tank that weekend. I just thought that I was, again, a bit of a problem drinker. The college suggested that I do the alcohol awareness counseling that they had available 2 years after my first encounter with such. And again, I thought it was just a lot of nonsense. That experience with the AA meeting still stuck with me because I compared without identifying with what everyone was saying. Off and on trouble from that moment until 2006. And in 2006, as the literature states, as Kimberly described in her share, the progression progresses. It does what it does. I thought I could white knuckle my way through it. I thought I could just be a responsible person and set limits and all of these fictions and misunderstandings about what the disease of alcoholism is. You know, that language right there, set restrictions, you know, to be in charge of it. That right there was my failure to recognize what the problem was. And it wasn't until that holiday weekend, it was July 4th weekend in 2006, that I was bombed out of my gourd. My soon-to-be 22-year-old daughter, again, coincidence is canceled. Seeing her, seeing my wife, seeing that I just could not get a handle on this. It was all the anxiety, all the terror, all the isms surrounding the active alcoholism in which I was participating and engaging. And I thought, you know, I'm going to repeat every mistake that my parents repeated. It's going to be an unstable environment for our daughter. She's going to grow up with all the anxiety and terror that I had as a kid. And then I thought, the one thing, the one constant is that every time I was in trouble from being a teenager all the way through being an adult, I was drunk. Now, I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I was in trouble, I had been drinking, including a couple of times being an unconvicted felon myself, being pulled over and very charming to an officer and seeming like a responsible grown-up adult, as I would have, I'm sure, blown way past the 0.08 legal limit and being sent off on my way with just a warning because I seemed like I was an adult and had it together. But that weekend, it, you know, not to get corny, but it really was as if a light bulb went off. And I recognized that the one thing I haven't really tried to do was get help with drinking. So I called, as it turns out, my friend Chris. And he pointed me in the direction of the area that, the district in which I live, gave me a phone number. I was able to call, 24-hour hotline. They gave me a list of meetings that were very close by. I wasn't going anywhere that night. But the following day I started making calls and I started finding out, and I told my wife, who is still my wife, and my daughter, who is still my daughter, and we're still together, still living in the same place, because I had the really great luck of being what's called a high bottom drunk. While it may seem like a high bottom drunk in that I didn't lose everything and I didn't end up lying in a gutter, that bottom that I hit was as terrifying and as anxious and as terrified and terrifying as anything anyone else experiences. So I'm here to dispel the idea that high bottom is something different, because early on, I carried that through because I stayed married. I stayed together with my family, but Now that mother of mine that I've referenced, she died at the beginning of this year. Less than a month ago, I was back home for a memorial. I was able to speak at her memorial. I was able to be present. I was able to be a participant in all of that and grieve bitterly. Grieve that my mom at age 75 passed away. But the gratitude I have for not showing up drunk and being a, me, self-centered, so-and-so, because that was the behavior I exhibited as an active alcoholic, is yet another of uncounted gifts that I've been given by being here, taking suggestions, and recognizing that identifying without comparing will be the path into a productive, healthy, and sober life. So I am very happy to be here and very grateful to be sober. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Rich. And thank you for using the phrase so-and-so instead of other sordid words. I could identify all the way back to the high school drinking and all that. And, you know, I never got a DWI, but I remember one night getting pulled over and the policeman insisted that I go right home. But if he had asked me to get out of the car, I don't think I could have, you know, I would have fallen on the ground and I was so drunk, but somehow we all got through that. But anyway, thanks again to both Rich and Kimberly. Everybody, please let your friends know about our meeting. This is an open meeting, so it's also ideal for friends who want to learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep this in mind when doing cooperation with the professional community or public information work. And I'd like to invite Kimberly to close us out in the manner of her choice.
A moment of silence for the still sick and suffering, followed by the serenity prayer, because that was a very big tool I used this past week. Sorry. God.
Grant me the serenity.
To accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks for attending, and have a great week.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Kimberly. Catch you all down the line.
Bye-bye.